Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from Chicago, and I'll be the host for the presentation today. And today is Sunday, December 22nd, 2024. The share ID numbers for Friday, December 20th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 22,013. That's 22013. And for the 10 a.m. meeting on Friday, that number is 22,014. That's 22014. This morning, A Vision for You presents Step 12, Working with Others. So our speaker is going to bring to life Chapter 7, sharing her personal experiences and insights as well. So looking forward to that. You know, if somebody would have told me when I first arrived to OA, can you remember when you first got here? I'm sure we all can, right? But if someone would have told me when I first got here that I was going to have to help other people, I think I would have walked out. I was so full of selfishness runs deep. But that is indeed what part of the deal is, right? And by the time that we reach step 12, if we have followed these instructions precisely, not perfectly, but certainly precisely, we're very different people than we were when we first began the process. And, in following these steps, probably we're going to be, by that time, we're going to be more selfless, more honest, compassionate, kind. We vary, but that's what we generally see. And we're going to want to help others find the freedom and joy that we've found in recovery. That's the deal. And it's not a burden to be of service. It's the bright spot of our lives. That's what the big book tells us. And that's been my experience. And step 12 is the only step in the book that has an entire chapter devoted to it. So the entirety of chapter 7 is devoted to working with others, which should speak to just how important this step is. I mean, they're all important, but this step certainly has some great importance, right? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So step 12 signifies the act of carrying the message by sharing your personal experience of recovery with others. One hand, one alcoholic, one compulsive overeater to another. We were once struggling with addiction. We're not struggling with addiction today. It essentially serves as a means to maintain our own sobriety while helping others achieve theirs through, offering support and guidance so that they can see their way through these steps. And the book does, I've often heard it said that we'll let the book do the heavy lifting here, right? But certainly we need people, just as Dr. Bob needed Bill and so on and so forth, right? And step 12 emphasizes the principles of practicing these learn principles in all aspects of our lives, all our affairs, and actively helping others find the same freedom that we found. So joining us this morning to elaborate on step 12 is Melissa C. And she's a recovered compulsive overeater from New York. And Melissa is dedicated to our 12-step way of life. And she's committed to carrying a message of hope to our fellowship, and we so appreciate that. And so it's with sincere appreciation and gratitude to welcome Melissa C. to the line this morning. Good morning, Melissa.
Hey, good morning, Larry. Thank you so much for your awesome intro. Good morning, everybody. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I come from the state of New York. And it's a pleasure, it's a real pleasure to be given an opportunity to speak about, I think, such an important part of our program. Before I jump into this chapter, which is such a rich chapter, there's so much in here. I only hope I can, do it justice and get everything in that I want to say. Just want to quickly qualify, sort of claim my seat here, let people know who might not know, why I would even have anything to speak of on this subject. I have been a compulsive overeater. I believe, from my earliest memories, I've had a different feeling about food than I believe that my that others have had. I've had a different relationship with food. I was always battling food. I was always like in the ring with food, and I struggled at times with morbid obesity. I was constantly on a diet. My entire life was spent dieting. Sometimes I would lose weight, you know, and look normal for a moment. But my head was crazy. It was like, you know, truly holding my breath underwater. I never maintained a healthy body weight for any length of time. I was either losing or gaining. And when I finally arrived here for the last, you know, hope I say for the last time, because I had been in and out of OA. But it's going to be 11 years since I have entirely surrendered, till I became entirely abstinent and decided that I was willing to do anything to get well. And in that time, I have been relieved over 160 pounds. You know, I came in here, I was morbidly obese. I do not, you know, I am not morbidly obese anymore. I have none of the physical consequences of having suffered this disease. And I have had a spiritual awakening. I physically look different, but I'm internally transformed. My entire life has improved as a result. And I'm truly grateful for this meeting, because I stumbled into this meeting accidentally, you know, after a period of trying OA. I call it OA Light. I always did the OA Light program, which I think I made it up. You know, it was take what you want and leave the rest. And it was basically take what was really easy and leave everything that seemed crazy, complicated, too difficult, too much, you know. But when I came here accidentally, I heard something that I couldn't believe what I heard. First of all, I heard people identify as recovered. And I thought, who the heck do these people think they are? How arrogant, you know? And yet I could not, like, stop listening, because I remember I was like, wait, what did they say? What was that? And then there was something, you know, there was something in the demeanor, the way that the message was carried, that I knew these people meant business. And I knew you all had what I wanted. And I became willing to do what it is that, you know, would get me that. And so I have, you know, I have since recovered, and I'm really passionate about this program. It's an incredible program. It has improved every single area of my life. And this particular chapter, working with others, is truly a passion for me. You know, I want nothing more. Really, I want nothing more. You know, I've had a spiritual experience, and, you know, I say, like, you know, it comes right out of the big book. God entered my heart and you know, and changed me. And I feel that change, what that has occurred for me, is it makes me authentically interested in helping other people, not being their boss. You know, I joke when I say, like, you know, oh, I never came here wanting to help anybody. I kind of liked the idea of telling people what to do. That really thrilled me. And yet that's not what this is. This is like, I want to help people form their own relationship with God. And this chapter specifically lays it out. And, you know, before I jump into the chapter, I'm also a studier of the AA 12 and 12. I think it's gotten it's approved literature, so I can quote it and I can bring it out. Because in order to authentically, you know, work with others to carry the message, the requirement is to have had a spiritual awakening. And so, you know, in the AA 12 and 12 on page 106, it asks that big question: what do you mean when you talk about a spiritual awakening? And the answer, it comes on the bottom of that page, and it continues on to page 107. Again, this is in the AA 12 and 12, and it says this: when a man or woman has had a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed. And then it further goes on to say that one finds themselves in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love of which he had thought himself quite incapable. And that, for me, really explains what has happened. You know, food no longer calls my name. I could pinch myself, but that's the truth. Like, I could make myself for a small period of time not eat, right? For a small period of time, and then I could not do that any longer, right? But I could never make myself not want it. Like, that is only the work of my creator, that I have a possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, and peace of mind, and love, and I thought myself incapable of that. So I'm far more honest today than I ever had been, because I'm not really overly concerned with, with pleasing the masses. You know, that's not my job. My job is to be pleasing to my creator. And I have more tolerance, so I'm able to withstand, you know, the regular stuff that people do. I don't feel so sensitive to other people. And I feel far less selfish. I often want to give to other people. And I have peace of mind and love. I feel much calmer, more serene. I'm not really worried. You know, I believe that there's a God that's running the show. And he doesn't really need me to help him do that. He just wants me to be his agent to work for him. So with that being said, now let's jump into this chapter, working with others. Okay, I'm going to get right to the beginning. It says on the first paragraph, page 89, that practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking, in our case, compulsive eating, as intensive work with other alcoholics, or in our case, other compulsive eaters. You can help when no one else can. Remember, they're ill. They're very ill. And so, you know, I talk about immunity and you know, what does it mean to have immunity? Well, it means that we can resist a particular infection. I can resist, you know, the consequences. I can resist the pull of the food, the desire for food. You know, immunity also means protection, to be exempt from something, especially an obligation or a penalty. So when I say, like, I'm safe and protected, right, that it's not my willpower that's keeping me from eating off my food plan, from eating my alcoholic foods. You know, it's protection. It's God's protection. And immunity is also the lack of susceptibility, especially to something unwelcome and harmful. And I think about it like this. It's my immunization. It's like an injection. It's how we stay protected. So working with others is how we remain safe. It's how we get our immunity. You know, it's like if I needed an injection for a specific illness. There are certain ones, you know, you get the immunization once. You know, I think, I don't remember what it was, but I think it was smallpox or polio as a kid, and I don't think I've ever had to take it again. But this one seems to require, for compulsive eating, I seem to require boosters. You know, I need it frequent and often and intense, right? Intense work is mentioned here. So intense work is not convenient work, and it's not easy, and it's not occasional. You know, it's not a daily check-in call. I used to like those, like, let me just check in kind of a call. And it's not working with others when it's convenient, right? This disease was not convenient. I didn't eat occasionally, and the consequences for me were anything but easy, right? So my solution, the way that I work with others, is not convenient, and it's not easy, and it's not occasional. And then it says we can help in ways that no one else can. We have the experience needed for this work, and it's important also to note that the people that we're helping, they're sick, you know, like me, not bad. So when people struggle, you know, especially when they go back to the food, there's all this shame, there's all this feeling of badness, you know, that oh my God, I was bad. No, this is an illness. This is a sickness. And nobody would think that I was bad if I started sneezing because I was, you know, exposed to an illness. You know, and it's the same thing here, right? Okay, next it says life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And, you know, prior to the recording, there was a little bit of chatter about the OA birthday, and I'm definitely going to put a pitch in for that because you want to see people recover. You want to see people help others. You want to be in the mix where you see loneliness vanish, to have a fellowship, a host of friends, an experience you must not miss. If you can find your way to LA for the OA birthday, you will see that in full action. I know I don't want to miss it. That contact with newcomers and with each other really is a great joy. You know, our lives begin to have meaning and purpose. There's an importance to our very existence. We see people get well. We see them help others, and we get to be a part of their transformation. And it really is exciting and fulfilling. And the relationships and the friendships we make are gifts that we never knew that were in store for us. That's been my experience. I never knew what kind of a gift I was going to receive by working intensively with other people. And yet, you know, I also want to mention this particular chapter uses the word friend 16 times. That's no mistake. I don't think, you know, Bill's pretty selective about his words. And so, yeah, we build relationships and friendships here among one another. Page 89 tells us, okay, how are we going to form these relationships? Well, don't start out as an evangelist or reformer. And why? Why can't I be this way? I mean, after all, I found the answer, right? I've struggled with this food problem my whole life, and now, folks, I know exactly what, you know, what to do and how to do it, and here's what you got to do. And okay, I can't be a reformer because it's not helpful, right? Evangelists and reformers, they turn people off. They, you know, and if we remember that we just want to be helpful. And I can't help people who are repelled by my behavior and who are turned off by my demeanor. And I think, like, when I look in the big book and I read, like, you know, Bill's story, and I think about one of the things that really drew Bill in to Ebby, when Ebby showed up, it was his demeanor. He did not rant and he did not preach. It said that his eyes were aglow, that he was like, I think about it like this. He was like a shiny penny. Like, he was bright and glowing and his eyes were alive. And I know that that has happened for me. I feel it. I mean, I've had people, someone said to me at work one time, you shine. You're like glowing. Feel it. I do feel it. And I've seen it happen in other people. That's the best way that we carry the message, right? And then, because of our own drinking experience, we can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. You know, I often hear, you know, that phrase that we're just another bozo on the bus. And I haven't found that in the Big Book. The Big Book actually tells me that I'm uniquely useful, meaning I have the precise qualifications for this job, the job of helping whomever God puts before me, not the job of curing people from compulsive eating. But I believe that I am an agent. I work for God, and God puts in front of me and puts in front of all of us the people we're supposed to help. And, you know, when I read that my own experience was what makes me uniquely useful, what it tells me is that all of my struggles, all of the years that I spent struggling with this disease, they were not a waste of time. So I never have to feel like, oh, I wish I got this earlier. I actually don't wish I got it earlier. I am really happy that I got it exactly when I got it, because there were experiences that I needed to experience in order to help someone else that I would never have had I found it earlier. And, you know, and so my struggles, I call them my on-the-job training. You know, it was my internship, so that I'm best able to do the work that God assigns me. Page 90. Okay, what happens if we find someone who doesn't want to stop eating? Well, we're told, don't waste your time trying to persuade them, because you're going to spoil a later opportunity. And be patient, realizing that you're dealing with a sick person. So again, we get this reminder that that the person is sick and they're not bad. And, you know, how do I know? How can we best know if someone doesn't want to stop? Is it because they pick up the food? Is it because they're struggling? You know, no, I think not. I think, you know, powerlessness is why people often pick up the food, even when they want it, right? Even when they want to recover, it's because they don't have the power yet to leave it alone. So how do I know if someone doesn't want to stop then? Well, my experience is people who don't want to stop try to negotiate. You know, they're going to lay out the terms. They're going to give you excuses. They may actually give reasons. You know, my experience is people who don't want to, you know, who aren't really interested, they don't call on time, right? It's not like, okay, an occasional they didn't call you on time, but it's a consistent, they don't call you on time. And they actually might tell you that they don't want to, or they don't feel ready yet. And when somebody says that, we don't chase them down. We don't push people. We don't chase them down. The disease sells the solution more than we do. You know, otherwise what we're doing is merely frothy emotional appeal. And I've had experiences where people will call me, and then within a couple of minutes, it's really clear that they want to kind of lay out the terms for how they're going to do it. And I listen, I let them speak, I don't cut them off, and then I very gently say, yeah, no, that's not the way I do it. You know, I think you're probably best to, you know, to reflect some more, or, you know, I don't think I have what you want. And what I found is that people, when I don't come on like a reformer, when I make no demands, when I just kind of lay it out, you know, when they are ready, I feel like I've been a safe space to come back to, and they kind of know what they're getting, right? It's not, they're not going to engage in the art of negotiation. So we're also told, you know, what do we do when we start carrying this message to someone? Page 91 says that you engage in general conversation. So here's a practice that I've done. You know, I ask general questions. I think we have this great, you know, we've got this really powerful phone meeting, and I love conversations on the phone. But I think early conversations are so powerful when you can meet the person eye to eye, when you can really see them. And we also have technology today. So I will give people, you know, if they want to talk to me and they're asking for help, I give them like a Zoom link. And I say, come, let's have a talk together. And I sort of start out like this. I tell people, like, you know, oftentimes what we get is we get someone calling to, and they ask if you can sponsor them. Are you available to sponsor? And I usually say, like, I never say yes and I never say no right off the bat. I say, why don't we have a conversation? Let's have a little chat. And I do what it says on page 91. It says, ask general conversations. Ask them general questions. What does that mean? I ask them about their job, their family, you know, where they live. I try to get some information about them. And then after a while, it says, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell them enough about your own habits, your symptoms and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If they wish to speak, let them do so. So I don't shut people off. I don't shut them down. And the idea is really to get them talking, which I have to say for me requires discipline because I talk a lot. I'm like a real talker. So I have to like practice. Okay, be quiet now, Melissa. Be quiet. Like listen, just listen. And because I want to get an idea of how I'm going to proceed. That's what it says. And if the person is not communicative, if they're real quiet, then I give them a sketch, it says, of my drinking career up until the time I quit, but say nothing of the moment for how that was accomplished. So I don't go right in off the bat telling people what they're going to have to do, right? No, we're not actually supposed to tell them how we stopped. We're just supposed to get them to share the necessity for stopping. If the person is in a serious mood, then I can dwell on all the troubles that food caused me, but I'm careful not to moralize or lecture. If the person's mood is light, tell them humorous stories of your escapades and get him to tell some of his. So, you know, I think basically we know Bill was an amazing salesman, brilliant, and he used that, you know, that skill set to help sell the ideas to the alcoholic. And I think what we get is we get schooled right now in the art of selling. So when I talk with someone, I talk about my eating and my dieting habits and my experiences. I talk about my painful weight fluctuations. I share, you know, the binges that made me physically sick, how I would be physically sick and yet feeling physically sick, I would look for the next bite that would sort of counteract the sickness that I caused by my eating. So I was on a perpetual savory, sweet, creamy, crunchy, salty, smooth chase, constant, and I would be physically sick. I share that. I share, you know, how I missed important social obligations and celebrations, how I spent so much of my life, sitting on the couch, fantasizing in my head, someday when I'm thin, I'll. That was my theme song, Someday When I'm Thin, I'll. And that was really sad that I missed a dear friend's funeral. I share that story with people, that I sat at home and cried because I couldn't find anything decent to wear to her funeral, and I didn't want her siblings to see how fat I'd gotten. So if they're in a depressed mood, I take out my most painful stories and I use that approach. But if the person is laughing, you know, that kind of nervous laughter, then I tell my stories with a humorous angle. You know, I talk about the cabbage soup diet, and lots of us can relate to that. But, you know, I call it my witch's brew. It was my Sunday cure that I was going to cook up this soup that was going to make me thin. And basically all it caused me was, like, painful gas. And, you know, and I share a story about how I did cabbage soup so I could fit into a pair of jeans so I could wear to a particular party, and I found myself at that party sitting next to this boy I really liked in the jeans that I, you know, cabbage souped my way into, and my stomach started making sounds so it sounded like I had swallowed a cat. And he even looked at me like, what? And I spent the rest of the night, you know, in the bathroom. And I tell that story if people are laughing because it sort of opens up. It kind of opens them up to speak some more. Okay, page 92 then says, tell them how you're baffled, how you were puzzled, that you finally learned that you were sick. Give them an account of the struggles you made to stop, showing the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. And we suggest you do this as we have done it in the chapter on alcoholism. And if he's an alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. And so again, this really illustrates just how valuable the sufferings of my experiences are. The way that we sell the solution is we allow the person to see the need for the solution. You know, in the chapter more about alcoholism, that entire chapter drives home the point that if one is a true compulsive overeater, there is no chance that he can do the job alone. And that's really what I'm trying to, like, get across, you know, in sharing with the newcomer, that this is something that cannot be done alone, you know, and that, you know, that we have no effective mental defense against the first drink, and that our defense has got to come from a higher power. That's what we're trying to lead the person to see, right? Okay, so now, if I'm satisfied, right, I've had these conversations with the person, they're leaning in, they're listening, they start, you know, you start to get the sense that, yes, they really have this thing. Okay, what do? We dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady, right? We actually dwell on the hopelessness. We don't tell people, oh, good, you're here. It's going to get better now, you know, because that's dishonest. You know, this meeting is a great meeting, but this meeting got better just from coming to this meeting and hearing about the program. No, it's the same thing with these early conversations. Just finding out that this is a disease does not get anybody well. So we don't cheer people up. What do? We show him from our own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. So I again drill into the hopeless feature. I explain that my willpower does not function normally. And I don't discuss it in a way that's lecturing. I try not to lecture them about willpower. But I give them my experiences with utilizing willpower. I tell them about the money I spent on commercial diets, on gym memberships. I had a false belief that if it was really, really expensive and crazy, if it sounded crazy and extreme and it cost a lot of money, it was going to work, right? And I would spend a small fortune on prepackaged foods. You know, I got prescriptions for Fen-Phen. That was all the rage, you know, when I was in my early 20s. That's what everybody was doing. And I, you know, utilized other types of medical solutions. I went to, you know, a hospital outpatient program with, you know, 500 calorie a day shakes. I did all kinds of things. And I share that. And all of those things I did, they worked for a period of time because every single one of them were calling upon willpower. And then, you know, typical for me, I would get this idea that I ought to be able to have a slice of pizza with my family. That was my idea on a Friday night, right? Because I would say, okay, I've been doing really well. It's Friday night. It's pizza night in this house, in the Crow House. It's pizza night, and I'm going to have a slice. But I would always wind up eating three slices and then attempting to wrap the rest of the pie up. I would eat the rest of it, and then I would binge the rest of the night. And I try to remember to stress me, not them, right? So when I tell other people that I cannot utilize willpower, I don't say you can't utilize willpower. I tell them my experience with willpower. I name myself as a compulsive eater. I don't tell someone else that they are. We're to let them come to this conclusion on their own. The diagnosis must come from within. Very different from other diseases, right? Other illnesses, you go to the doctor diagnoses you. This here requirement is that you diagnose yourself, right? Page 93 explains what comes next. We really, really want to get people to ask this question. I think about this as sort of like, you know, this is like if you're fishing, right? This is when the compulsive overeater, if you're fishing, where they bite the worm, where they take the hook and now they're hooked, right? You want to get them to ask, what did you do to get well? This is the question that gives us the freedom to talk about the spiritual feature. Before this, I didn't really talk about the spiritual feature at all. I just talked about my necessity for a spiritual solution, that I, on my own, could never do it, that I had no power. So we talk about the spiritual feature, but we don't get into a religious discussion. And here are some really important points. He does not have to agree with our conception, with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing, the most important thing, is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. And so, you know, I've often gotten this kind of situation. Somebody says, well, I don't believe in God. And I say, okay, do you want to? Do you want to believe in God? If they say no, I don't want to, I have nothing left to offer them. Because, now remember, it's God of your own understanding, right? But my job before this point is to convince them of the necessity to believe in God. The rest of this book, this entire book, by the way, is to enable a person to form a relationship, to help a person form a relationship with a power, with God, right? A power greater than themselves, which will solve their problem. So if somebody tells me that they don't want to, right, they're not really, then I hear they're not really interested, because this is a program for people who have exhausted every other solution, right? And so they have to agree that they're willing to consider that there's something bigger that can help. And they have to start living a better life by living spiritual principles. And what does that mean, right? Does that mean you start going to church, you start going to synagogue? Not necessarily, although, you know, that's certainly a great avenue. But spiritual principles, I say it's like this. Stop doing the things that you know are wrong, right? Sometimes people say, well, I don't really know what God wants me to do. You probably know what God doesn't want you to do. No stealing, no lying, no abusive acts, no cruel words, and start looking for ways to help others. And one thing I would say that often needs accentuating for people is to focus on your own behaviors and not the rest of the world, right? People oftentimes come in, I know how I came in, I was full of dissatisfaction with the rest of the world. And what I really needed to focus on, like most days, what I still need to focus on is my own behavior, right? Page 94 says, we're dealing only with general principles common to most denominations. So again, this doesn't really have anything to do with a specific religion. And what do? We outline for the person, once they ask, okay, now what? You outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, explain what you did, how you straightened out your past, and why you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for that person to know that your attempt to pass this on is part of your own recovery, that they're helping you more than you're helping them, and that they're under no obligation. The only thing is that you hope that they'll try to help others when they escape their own difficulties, that it's important that they place the welfare of other people ahead of their own and make it clear that he's not under pressure. He needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you have helped him. And I love this last line of that paragraph. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. So what do we do, right? We tell the person about the steps, and you really stress right in the beginning the importance of passing this on. In fact, one of the earliest things that I do with sponsees and potential sponsees is we look at the doctor's opinion together, and it's actually mentioned. This necessity for helping others is mentioned right on the first page of the doctor's opinion. You know, oftentimes people love the doctor's opinion, and I myself do too, because they find out about the allergy. And what their big takeaway, my initial takeaway from the doctor's opinion was, oh, I can't eat blank. And that's important information, but even more important is I have to start being helpful to other people that my very life is going to depend on it. You know, the doctor's opinion says this as part of his rehabilitation. He commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. So, you know, I said before, like, Bill was an amazing salesperson, and that we learn how to kind of sell the solution to people, right? But he wasn't tricking. There was no trickery here. We don't trick anyone into the real terms of this agreement. What are the terms of the agreement? That right off the bat, we tell the person that in order to get well and remain well, they will have to help others. There's no trick there. These are the terms I always lay out when I'm working with another. And for me, what does that look like? I tell somebody, you know, in our early conversations when we're working together, what was done with me. That if you're interested in working with me, it means that you will allow me to call upon you if I think that there's somebody that you can be helpful for. And what that kind of looks like for us is, you know, we have like these kind of walking directories of phone numbers, of powerful meetings, of podcasts and the like. And I believe that that if I'm going to work with somebody, that their phone number should be able to be given out to someone else whom I think it might benefit. And that's an agreement that I make with other people. I think, you know, I know there's this lots of talk about anonymity. I don't believe that I give away the secrets that people share with me. But if I know somebody has a set of experiences with a specific topic, a specific difficulty, and I think that they have the capacity to help someone else, and well, I want to be able to tell that someone else, a good person to reach out to. Because, you know, as a sponsor, as a fellow in this program, we are never the only voice that anybody should ever hear. We cannot be the solution. We are to put people's hands in the hands of God. And I think that requires a fellowship community. You know, the other thing is that we give people a chance to think it over before agreeing to continue to work with us. I do that. I tell people, like, listen, you know, we've had a bunch of conversations together. I usually to do, you know, to sort of demonstrate willingness. I think it's, you know, you have to be willing to go to any length. I don't know if they're willing. I give to do. And if they do it and they seem willing and we have these conversations and they seem like they're interested, I give them time to think it over, you know, and I make it really clear if they don't want to work with me, I won't be upset. And if I see them at a meeting or I pass them on the street or they call me sometime in the future, I will still greet them warmly and I will still offer them fellowship. And here's the line in here, I just love it. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you may have perhaps made a friend. So we're calm. We're nice, right? We're not yelling. We're not arguing. We're not bullying. In fact, you know, we sometimes come across people, I've come across people who are all revved up, you know, and I've been all revved up. But we're really supposed to kind of temper that, you know, to sort of take a step back, that we're not evangelists, we're not reformers. And I love you have perhaps made a friend, right? I think it's important that the people that we're reaching out to help, whether they choose to be helped by us or not, will view us as a friend. Why? Well, we never know if at a later date that person is going to want to come back, right? Is going to want to call upon you for help. And if you were not friendly and kind to them, you know, we run the risk of them being turned off to Overeaters Anonymous. I want to be a good representative for this program. That really is my desire. And my experience has been this. People put out their hand to me in friendship and support, and I was a hot mess sponsee. I years ago, asked someone for help. I didn't like what she said, and I actually hung up on her. Like, click. And then years later, turns out she was the person I asked for help. And she acted as though she didn't even remember my foolish behavior. And I've had situations with people who have left and then returned. And I think it like this. We leave the porch light on and the welcome mat out. And that's what it means to really carry the message. So page 95 says, okay, if they're not interested in your solution, you may have to drop them until they change their mind. How do I know if someone's not interested in my solution? Well, they won't do any of the work. They don't do anything that I ask them to do. Not necessarily because they struggle with the food, right? I think oftentimes people early on struggle, and then we can, you know, give them structures and scaffolds that can help them. But my experience has been that people who are not interested in the solution, they try to negotiate, right? And they try to tell you how they're going to do it. And when that happens, I lovingly say, it sounds like you know exactly what you need. That's not really what I have to offer. And, you know, and so if someone thinks that they can do the job some other way, we encourage them, follow their own conscience. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that worked with us. In any case, be friendly. Yep, there's that word again. Let it go at that. We don't waste our time trying to convince someone, right, who doesn't want to work with you. We don't water down the truth, right? You know, a requirement for working this program is willingness, willing to go to any length. And so I'm a school teacher. I've shared that a lot, right? My job as a second grade teacher is actually, I'm supposed to differentiate the instruction. I'm supposed to tweak the directions and the instruction so that more students can learn. And actually, in 12 steps, I'm actually not supposed to do that. I am not supposed to tweak and water down or give things in bite-sized chunks so that more people learn it. I'm supposed to tell the truth and let God put the right teacher in front of the right student at the right time, right? And so I don't waste my time trying to convince anyone. What we're supposed to do is we search out another and try again, right? You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what we have to offer. It's a waste of time to keep chasing a man. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced he cannot recover by himself. And it says like Bill failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. And he often says that if he continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. So, okay, don't be discouraged. I should never be discouraged if someone doesn't want to do this or if somebody falls aside. Instead, find someone desperate. You know, desperation is essential. If someone is not desperate, right? Desperate, meaning out of ideas, no more tricks, no more schemes, no more OA light, right? I can't create desperation. And I actually found out I'm not all that good at assessing someone's desperation just by looking at them. I used to think I could. I used to think, oh my gosh, that person is desperate. Yes, they're desperate. And yet, I'm not really good at assessing someone's desperation because I tend to view it from a physical perspective, and I've met people who did not look like they were suffering from this disease, but they were, you know, and they were just as desperate as someone, if not more, than somebody who might be walking around over 300 pounds. So, you know, it says here, like, this idea about working, you know, if he continued to work on them. And I think that word on is important. You know, we don't work on anyone. We're not surgeons. I'm not working on anyone. And I think that's God's job, to work on someone. But rather, the name of this chapter is working with others. So we work with them. It's never our job to get anybody recovered. That's not my job. My job is to carry the message. I really have no idea where I am meeting people on their spiritual journeys. You know, are they in, you know, kindergarten as far as their spiritual journey? You know, are they, am I just planting the seed? You know, or are they further along on their journey? We don't really know, right? You know, there's, in page 98, it talks about if people, now they decide they want it, you know, they want the solution, but they sort of feel like they can't get it until everything else is in place, right? They clamor for this or that, claiming they cannot master alcohol. So the person says, yeah, I can't get my food thing together until my job is better, until my material needs are met. And we say, no, nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking. We don't stop eating compulsively so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. So I can't even honestly put the food down, right, until I start depending upon God. And that is a game changer because, you know, oftentimes people are, you know, want to think, okay, well, let me put the food down and then I'll be able to depend on God. But it actually says the opposite here, that I have to start depending on God. Now, what does that look like in early recovery? You know, what are some things that I would ask someone to do to demonstrate a necessity for dependence on God? Well, I say, like, spend some time in prayer and meditation, whatever that looks like for you. I don't tell anybody specifically how to pray. I think the Big Book actually has loads of prayers, and there are some great resources, which I can always share offline, for sites that actually go through the Big Book, and there's a prayer for each step. I ask, like, newcomers, start with that, you know. So we're to burn into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. So can anyone recover? Can everyone actually get well? Absolutely. That was the message I got at this meeting. That's what drew me in here. If you think that it cannot happen for you, you are mistaken. But you got to trust God, which for me started by getting rigorously honest. My honesty was a demonstration that I was going to trust God, that I was going to get out of the business of managing and controlling and allow God to take over, and that I was going to clean house, meaning that make the needed amends and restitutions, you know. And so how do we assist people? How do we assist and advise people? Now we've got this sponsee, right? We're telling them, trust God and clean house. And okay, how do we help them? Well, the next part talks about that when your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family, so he's cleaning up, you're assisting him in cleaning up the wreckage with his family, and he has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he's living, he should proceed to put those principles into action at home. So I always notice that it doesn't say apologize, grovel to your family, and expect instant forgiveness. No, we're told with our families, we make reparations, repair the damage, and often repay an amount. If we owe money, we repay it. If we've taken something that doesn't belong to us, we return it. And then the important part, to explain our new principles, and better than explaining them, demonstrate them, right? Though his family may be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. All right. So today we've got, post-pandemic, boy, we know an awful lot about avoiding a plague, right? I have to go to that same length to avoid argument and fault finding. And that's something that I would help a sponsee with, help them avoid argument and fault finding with their families, right? That they clean up the damage as best they can, explain to their family the new principles that they're trying to live by, and more important, they demonstrate it and stop fighting with their family, right? We are to demonstrate that we can be sober, considerate, and helpful regardless of what anyone says or does. And we all fall below this standard many times. But we must repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by a spree. So with a sponsee, oftentimes we also get asked, like, what if someone picks up? What if your sponsee eats, right? What do you do? Well, here I'm told that people pick up, they go off on a spree when they fall below the standard and they don't repair the damage immediately. So if they start running amok in their family and they don't clean it up, if they're not avoiding argument and fault finding like the plague, but if they're getting in the ring with people, we mess up, I mess up with my family, but I've been able to remain abstinent and recovered because I clean up my mistakes quickly. I don't, I make a mistake, I say something to my kids, and I, for me, I get in the business of management and control. That's like an area that I, have to work on. Or I find myself gossiping with a sibling about another sibling, and I'm like, oh, God, I can't believe I did that again. And I have to quickly clean it up immediately, right, if I want to live free from the food. And those are the things that I share with sponsees as well. Page 100, the first paragraph, this is probably one of the best promises in this program. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realized that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. And I think, okay, holy smokes, what an incredible promise. It's a gift. We get this great gift, and it means that the person that I am working with, along with myself, are walking together on this path together, getting a stronger connection with God. I'd say, this is the stuff that really creates tight bonds of friendship and fellowship, because we're both working together to get a stronger connection with God, that my disease is progressive, and so my recovery must be as well, and it is. I have experienced this truth, that my plans have paled in comparison to God's plans. My only hope when I came in here was to lose weight. I had no idea that was just, my friend says that was God's opening act. That was God's opening act. That I've been the recipient of so many wonderful gifts that at first seemed like anything but a gift. But if I adhere to the principles, I get to experience all circumstances as though they are wonderful adventures. Can you imagine? God gives us the ability to rise above our difficulties. When I began to take step 10, it says that we entered the world of the spirit. And I think that when we live in the world of the spirit, one of the things that we experience in this world is the ability to rise above our circumstances, that I just really don't seem to have my happiness attached to my mere circumstances anymore, that I can actually be living in a time of difficulty. And that's my truth. You know, there's difficulty with my mom, with her health. There's difficulty at times with my workplace, you know, difficulty in the world and my family. And yet, my happiness is no longer attached to my circumstances. God gives us the ability to be happy regardless. You know, so when we're working with a man and his family, it says not to participate in their quarrels because we might spoil a chance of being helpful if we do. So, you know, what does that mean? You know, and then it says, ask them to remember when they're impatient the blessed fact of his sobriety. So when a sponsee shares with you, you know, when a sponsee shares with me that their husband did something or their boyfriend did something or their mother did something or their kids did something, I'm not to participate in their quarrels. I don't jump in there and say, my God, they're what a jerk. I can't believe they did that. Or you should say this or you should say that. We're not to stir people up. What we can do is we point the light back on them and their part. But we can also be encouraging when they fall short, when they snap at their spouses, when they don't, you know, say the right thing to their kid or they get into it with their mother-in-law. We try to encourage our sponsees not to drift into morbid reflection, but rather, you know, it's okay to say, ooh, you got really mad. Let's clean this up. What are you going to do to clean this up? And then I ask the question, did you eat? Did you go back to the food? And happily, majority, you know, they say no. And I say, okay, so let's take a moment. Let's thank God for the blessed miracle that even in the midst of this difficulty, you did not go back to the food. That's miraculous, right? And so if we've been successful in solving our own domestic problems, we tell how that was accomplished. That way we can set people on the right track without becoming critical of them. And this really tells me this is what it means to be a friend to a sponsee. Because if I'm sharing my depths of my relationships, if I'm sharing with them, not just telling them what they do, but telling them what I've done, I'm opening myself up. First of all, I'm demonstrating humility, which is crucially important to our immunity, right? How we stay immune. And it's an important way how we teach and we lead always by example. I think it's always more powerful to show people what we did rather than tell people what to do. Okay, so now we're out there. I know I'm running out of time. We're living in the world, right? We're out here living in the world. And now what do we do? And especially important now that we're coming into the holiday season, because now we're supposed to be able to, you know, go to a place, 101, right? Here's page 101. Our rule is to not avoid a place where there's drinking if we have legitimate reason for being there. Okay, holidays are coming up, folks. Here's the important qualification. Ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere? If you answer satisfactorily, you can go or stay away, whichever seems best, but make sure you're on solid spiritual ground. Do not think of what you're going to get to the occasion, but what you can bring to it. But if you're shaky, you'd better work with another alcoholic instead. I'm going to tell you that throughout this holiday season, I don't say, oh, it's the holidays, I'm far too busy to pick up a new sponsee. If anything, it is a time to work more intensively, to work more diligently with others, right? That this is the thing that's going to bring me immunity. And, you know, I can go anywhere so long as my reasons for going are good. And it says here, like, why sit with a long face in places where there's drinking, sighing about the good old days? If there's a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure, right? Don't withdraw. I'm going to paraphrase here. We don't withdraw. You can explain to your friends why certain food behaviors disagree with you. I do it thoroughly. You know, the people who know me in my life, they know I go everywhere. I have a little lunchbox, and in my lunchbox is my emergency food, right? Because sometimes I can eat what's there. I have like my food kit, you know, what I can eat, And I have a little scale with me, and I bring that everywhere. And I really, I'm not like, I just take care of, it's no one else's responsibility but my own. And I go everywhere happy. You know, I show up, I'm with other people. And before I go anywhere, I meditate and I pray. And my prayer is always this: God, please allow me to find the person I'm meant to help. This is my prayer. God, show me who I'm supposed to help today. Use me to show others how amazingly powerful you are. Then when I go someplace, I try to seek out who I'm meant to help. It's like my, hide-and-seek mission. I look for someone. By the way, that person always shows up. And I'm going to close with this story that I had an experience where I went to my nephew's wedding. It was many years ago. I went to my nephew's wedding. I traveled out of state. I went to Texas to go to his wedding. And my nephew and his bride, his wife, now they have three kids, but at the time they were getting married, they were this young couple making a wedding for themselves in another state. They are vegetarians. And you would think, I eat a lot of vegetables. You would think that would be awesome for me. But they eat an enormous amount of foods that I don't eat. And it was like, that's what they were serving. That's what they served at their rehearsal dinner. That's what they served at their wedding. I prayed and I meditated before I went. I knew I was not going to discuss what I needed to eat with this young couple. They're getting married. They didn't need me to ask them about their food. I brought my food with me. And I ate my food actually en route to their wedding. And I prayed and I meditated before I got there. Please, God, just let me show up. Let me be useful to this young couple. Let me not look longingly at some of the foods that might have been okay-ish, right? I don't want to have any. My disease loves ambiguity. And I asked God to just show me clarity. Just let me eat what I brought and be okay. And what happened was, I'm waiting online to get a drink at this wedding, and standing next to me is this young guy. And I asked for a drink, and I asked the bartender, you know, for a club soda with lemon in it and make it look like a real drink, you know, and it was like my joke. And this young guy said to me next to me, you don't drink? And I said, oh, no, that ship sailed and sunk. And he whispered, he said, this is my first time being sober at an affair. I just got out of rehab. And I looked at him and I said, yeah, I said, I'm a friend of Bill's too. I said, how do you do these things sober? And I shared with him, I get the chills still when I tell this, I shared with him what my practice was. I said, I always, before I go, I ask God, show me how to be useful. Show me who to help. And I think, my friend, today that's you. That's how I do these things. I go, I show up, and I try to be of service. And guys, the best way that you can be of service, if you don't happen to stumble across another addict at an affair that you can be useful to, you can be useful at a wedding by dancing. You know, the bride and groom, they're paying a fortune for a band. They don't really care what you eat. What they want is they want to see people increase the pleasure. And what I think draws people in to working with others is they see people who are living joyous, happy, and free. And that is available for anyone and everyone. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa. I'm dancing with my lunchbox here. Thank you for such an informative, compassionate presentation. We're so appreciative of your generosity. And so we're going to quickly transition to an opportunity to pose a question for Melissa. But before we do, let me give you the share ID for today's presentation. That number is 22,015. That's 22,015. Also, we'll get Melissa's contact information at the end of the recorded portion after the Q&A, so please stay tuned, hang around for that. Now, if you have a question for Melissa, and we're going to end pretty near to the top of the hour, but press star one, give me your first name and last initial. I'll try to hear you best I can. So just questions only, please, in the interest of time. Who's the first person that I heard?
Hanayeta.
Okay, gotcha, Hanayeta. Oh, Thought I heard a gentleman, but I'm not sure. Who else?
Margaret B., Georgia.
Okay, Margaret.
Lisa M.
Lisa.
GP.
Hi, Pete. Gotcha. How about one more for now?
Amy G.
Okay, Amy. Yeah, let's stop there. Just let's get these in and let's see where we're at. So we got Hanayeta, we got Margaret, we got Lisa, we got Pete, and Amy. Let's on Hanayeta. Let's please mute. And Hanayeta, what question do you have? The one question for Melissa.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. So am I still unmuted?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you for your service, Larry K. And Melissa C., I always love to hear you. Wow. Everything was great. I have a question. If you were, what you just described is perfect, and outlined it great, but if not a but, it was. If you have someone who has been around for a long time, years, maybe even 20 years, and they're still not getting it. They ask you to be their sponsor. Do you just go through the same kind of thing? I mean, is there a different process? Is there something else that you can do to try to maybe, I mean, I know I would have to say, things like, do you think you really are a compulsive eater? Are you willing to go to any lengths? Those types of things. But would you still go into stories if you already know their story pretty much? Or, I mean, you know, anyway, that's my question. I hope that made sense.
So, I mean, would I ask them their stories? I would have to, just because someone's been around for a really long time does not mean that they have actually admitted powerlessness. You know, a lot of people, myself included, I did not understand that I was powerless. I really thought that I had the power. You know, so I think it's hard. It's like a pretty general question, but those are where I think it's really important that I have a lengthy conversation with the person, identifying what is it, what do they think is their stumbling block. You know, sometimes it's they're not willing. They're really not willing. You know, they might know a lot, but they're not perhaps willing to do a lot or do the right things. So yeah, I would think it is important to have those conversations with people. Yeah.
Thanks, Hanayeta. Okay, next up with the question is Margaret, followed by Lisa. Margaret, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Melissa. This is just a pretty quick one. In your experience as beginning to do Step 12, did your sponsor just say, "Go out, my child, and you know, sin no more and cure the world"? And sponsor somebody, or did they work with you, you know, as you were learning to sponsor other people? And then what was the other question? Oh, I don't remember the other question, but that's basically it. What was it like for you when you were first starting to sponsor? And I guess, and then how did it change over the years?
Yeah, I think, listen, we make a lot of mistakes. How's that? I made a lot of mistakes. I think my early initials with sponsorship was I was going to tell everybody exactly what they had to do, how they were going to do it, and then I would get mad when they didn't do it exactly the way that I wanted them to do it. I negotiated the terms with people constantly. I think I was an evangelist and reformer. First conversation people had, I was like already telling them what they can and cannot eat. Like I was like in there way too much. So I think I've learned by by my failure, not by others' failure, but by my inability to effectively do it. Yeah.
Thanks, Margaret, for that question. And then Lisa, followed by Pete. Good morning, Lisa. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks, Larry, for your service, and thanks, Melissa, for your lead today. And I just have a question, and I know it may bring about some controversy, I think, in program, but what is your view, or what do you think the Big Book says about required abstinence prior to starting the steps versus like a length of time? I've heard 2 days, I've heard a week. prior to getting in on the doctor's opinion, or just kind of the person, you know, putting the food down and jumping right into the steps.
Right.
Like the
so
next
this
minute.
Definitely,
and
yeah,
then,
yeah. I'm going to, yeah. So this is, you know, there's been great, right, there's great battles fought over those things. I have a specific perspective, and yet there's other people here who I know give incredible service who have a different perspective than me. And I actually believe that God is so incredibly wise and powerful that he brings the right people to the right messengers for the right things. I don't, you know, when I work with someone, I assist them. I help them as they're getting food sober, as they're getting abstinent. I believe in strongly in the doctor's opinion. It talks about the hospitalization period. I've kind of, you know, I have kind of like reframed that for compulsive eaters. I think like we can assist people in this hospitalization, but I actually believe that we can start as soon as someone is willing and ready. And I for me, I look at like Ebby carried the message to Bill, and Bill was drinking. Bill was actually drinking that day, and Bill and Ebby still took the time to speak with him. I would not tell somebody to go out and make amends, and then you're going to get abstinent. I think there's sometimes, and I also want to be careful because I don't want anybody that I'm working with to get this idea, especially if they're abstinent. Oh, go eat because it's okay. It's not okay, right? But we can begin some of the work together as the person is intensively doing everything within their human power to put the food down, right? They're going to cooperate with God and the removal of the desire. And, yeah, I'll pass at that.
Oh, thanks so much for the question, Lisa, and for the answer, Melissa. Okay, next up we have Pete, followed by Amy. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks so much for your service. I appreciate it. My name is Pete B. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm recovered today by God's grace and mercy. And Melissa, wow, that was so good. I can't wait to listen to it again. But in any case, so could you talk about the difference between recovery and using the tools of recovery? And are the tools of recovery, that OA's tools of recovery, are they necessary to become recovered?
So I, yeah, no, thanks, Pete. I'm like, I'm getting ready. What's the hard question? What's the what's the difficult question? I'm going to say, yeah, I think the tools are really necessary. You know, someone explained it to me. I obviously, it's not my words, that the tools are the handrails to the steps. The tools cannot be the only thing. I cannot just work with, I tried to work a tool-based program, right? And tools alone availed me nothing. I actually had to do the steps. But I need the tools. I needed, you know, for me, I needed other people. I loved, you know, I love people. I love to talk, obviously. But I also like to kind of do things my own way and then report back when I've done them successfully, right? I always want to come back the victor. And the tools actually is the other way. Uh-uh. You're going to lean on people. You're going to lean on structures and scaffolds that are not to your own making, that have been laid out before you, and you're going to work these steps. And that, for me, was necessary. Hope that answers your question. Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pete, and thanks, Melissa, on that. And Amy, good morning.
Hey, Larry, good morning. Hey, Melissa, thank you so much, both of you all, for your service. Melissa, I'm so appreciative. A lot of people, I think, you know, think that chapter can be outdated, and you just brought it alive and present tense for us, and I thank you so much. So, sorry, Amy G., compulsive overeater. Question is, with dealing with sponsees who are agnostic, now I know you said this idea of depending on God first. How do you frame it for them, for those who say that I don't believe in any kind of God? Like, for example, if you told me I had to trust God before I could work this program, I would have no concept, and I was so angry. So can you frame for sponsees that are dealing with that kind of agnosticism how you would sponsor them to get them started?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I meet a lot of people like that, myself included. You know, that really the importance of step one is coming to the end of your own human power, and that impressing upon the person they do not have to believe anything specific that I believe. They don't have to believe. They can. We're really told form your own conception, and one of the things that I've, you know, stressed with people is spend time in quiet reflection. Pick up the big book. There are prayers. You could start, you know, and there's a prayer, you know, there's basically a prayer is, you know, I've gotten it from my friend, but I've reworded it and tweaked it. Janet had like this, my friend Janet B had this great prayer. And I took it and I reworded it and it kind of worked for me. And it's basically, God, I don't know if you're there. I don't know that I believe in you. I don't know that you exist. But I need help. And there are other people who swear that you exist, who swear that you have helped them. And if, in fact, you are there and you have helped them and you've given them a miracle, I want one of those miracles too. And that's like a basic, anybody can pray that. It's basically telling God, I don't believe in you. I'm not sure that you're there. And then sit in quiet. You know, there's lots of things people do. People write, you know, people do some two-way prayer. There's lots of spiritual practices. The other thing that I love, which is right in We Agnostics in the book, it says, like, honestly, there's this line in there that I've used with people that says, like, you can honestly ask yourself, I wish I could find the page, what each of these spiritual terms mean to you. And so I've had people go through the book and look at the spiritual terms. It's a great exercise. And any term which is like capitalized, you know, that's sort of like a placeholder for God, spirit of the universe, creator, infinite power and love, there's like all these different terms. You can ask the person, are you willing to write all those terms down and ask what they honestly mean to you? And what I have found with people who are agnostic is as they start taking action, what happens for them is, what happened for me is that God reveals himself in whatever way is meant for them to see it. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Amy. You know what? Let's take, I know there's lots of other questions, but, and we'll get her contact information, but let's take one more. Who has a question for Melissa? One more person.
Hi, it's Diana.
Okay, Diana. Let's go with that. And Diana, go ahead and pose the question.
Hi. Thank you. What do you do with your sponsees when you've finished the 12 steps? And you've read, you know, 164 pages of the book. What do you go through afterward with your sponsees?
Okay, so after that, after, you know, when they have recovered, right? When they're done with the done, right? They're never done. What do they do then?
Right.
They work on 10, 11, and 12. I believe in strongly in those living those steps. It's not just like a catchphrase, but it actually is. So what are the things that I do with sponsees? And first of all, it depends on where each person is and what they need. Some people recover, they get well, they just sort of send me their food and a little bit, you know, reach out every now and then. That's okay. Others need to be in more close contact. They want to, like, remain. They share their inventory. I, in turn, will often share mine as well at times. And we practice this program, you know. They go on and practice this program. The agreement is that they will sponsor. That is, like, they have a very short amount of time to get a sponsee. If they're not going to sponsor somebody, if they don't do the best, now it doesn't mean get and keep a sponsee, but it means like actively pursuing someone to sponsor. If they don't do that in a very short amount of time, I'm like, you know, I'm done. I'm done. But if they continue, but I do not like work the steps again. It's not like now we're going to work the steps again, because my belief is that I'm supposed to work intensively with still others so that others can get well. And I want to just say this. If I have like a sponsee who's like dragging their feet sometimes at the end of the steps, you know, they're often, sometimes they're like afraid of losing the structure of actively being sponsored. You know, I will remind them that their job is to have put their hand in God's hands, not in any other human hand, and that they're dragging their feet is actually hurting at least two people besides themselves, right? One is the person whose spot they're holding that I could be helping, and the second is the person who they're supposed to be out there helping. So I, you know, I kind of like help lovingly kind of kick them out of the nest a little bit, like go be helpful. Anyway, I hope that helps. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Diana. And yeah, we're going to bring it to a close. I know we could probably go another hour, but anyways, Melissa, thank you so much for such a compassionate, informative presentation and dealing with that Chapter 7. We're so appreciative. So thank you for that. And again, please hang out as we close here. Once we end the recorded portion, we'll ask Melissa for her contact information. So if you have questions for her, maybe you can bug her all day because she's got nothing else to do. Not really. Right? Okay. We're not a glum lot around here. That's for sure. So I'm going to read from page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until